Okay, so I'll just launch in. So this is the second talk in a series on the Tibetan Wheel of Life, which is this symbol depicted up here, which Ratnav, you had introduced last week. And I think it's a series of five or six talks. Erica is doing the next one. Yep. Helen's doing the next one. And Amaradeepa, the one after that. So this week is my job, which is quite challenging actually, to talk about conditionality, which is sort of it's a very large Buddhist concept. In fact, it's kind of the whole of Buddhism really, conditionality. So I'm going to talk about it a little bit in terms of a concept, what it means, and then I'm going to talk about it a little bit in terms of how it's depicted on the Wheel of Life, and we're going to do some little kind of exercise, or anyway, we'll do it when we get to it. I don't know what to call it without making it sound quite boring. But we're going to do something. So I just want to kind of do a caveat, I suppose. Like I said, conditionality is like the whole of the Dharma, the whole of Buddhism in a way. It underpins the whole of Buddhism. It was the central discovery the Buddhist made 2,500 years ago when he became enlightened. Although that sounds silly, really, conditionality is quite a small word for a huge awakening experience. But conditionality is the concept, I suppose, he came up to describe that, to describe what he discovered. So up here, I've written up some words. So paticca samuppada is the Pali word, so the ancient Indian word for what we translate as conditionality or conditioned co-production or dependent co-arising or dependent origination, none of which are kind of particularly catchy or illuminating, I think. So I'll just talk about what that means a little bit in the hope of illuminating what the Buddha was getting at, or what he discovered, really, what he realised. So I'll start with the West, because that's where we are. So in the West, since Buddhism arrived here, there's been a lot of interest in a kind of a general sense on the implications of conditionality or paticca samuppada. And at this very general level, conditionality points to how all things and events arise on the basis of all other things and events. So that's too abstract, I know, but as an example, there are enormous number of conditions that enable us to be alive, that enable us to thrive or, if not thrive, live on this planet. For example, there's the atmosphere, the sun, the oceans, all the people that grow our food, the plants that give out oxygen, and you know, so on and so on. There's just all these conditions that support human life on this planet, including you know, each other. All of us support each other in a way. So thinking about things in that way, which is you know, helpful and valid, gives us an idea of how conditioned and connected we are, how mutually conditioned we are by each other and by everything around us, and how interconnected we are. So there's a host of conditions all the time mutually affecting each other in that general sense, yeah? It's kind of obvious, but we take it for granted, I think. But that's not the whole story. That's interesting, and it can be really informative to reflect on that, and more than informative, actually, kind of illuminating in its own right to reflect on all the conditions that interact, that enable us to go about our lives. But it's not the whole story, because the Buddhist concept of conditionality points to a vision of reality that's much deeper than that. And I guess the older I get, the more I see that the way I interpret and explain the world depends on the lens that I'm looking through. And the lens that most of us, at least, are looking through is scientific materialism. That's our cultural lens, scientific materialism. That's how we have been conditioned to interpret the world. It's scientific materialism. And there's nothing wrong with that. Scientific materialism has been extremely helpful. It's the modern Western view, and it's been hugely beneficial. But it's not the only way of experiencing things or interpreting things. And it can, because we just take it for granted, really, that way of seeing the world, it can stand between us and other, maybe more broader or imaginative, maybe, way of seeing things. So what the Buddha's teaching on conditionality or realization of conditionality was that it's not just about material things like sunshine, trees, atmosphere, breathing, etc. It's about everything, including how our mind works and how our minds interact with other minds and with the world around us. How they mutually condition each other and evolve together. Okay, so I hope this is getting abstract, I know. It will get a little bit more abstract and a little bit less abstract, okay? So I'm going to quote from Joanna Macy, who's written a lot about this. She's an American woman who's been very influential in the field of general systems theory. And I was about to say she's always also a Buddhist. I'm not actually absolutely sure about that, but she certainly writes like a Buddhist. Anyway, she writes, a genuine understanding of mutual causality being conditionality, involves a transcendence of conventional dichotomies between self and world, which amounts to an overhauling of one's most ingrained assumptions. Yeah? So a transcendence of conventional dichotomies about self and world, and an overhauling of one's most ingrained assumptions. So now I'm just going to take a very small example. It won't, overhaul our most ingrained assumptions, most likely. But it might just hint to the meaning of mutual causality a little bit. Who was it? Jo told me that she thinks this has been done before on a Monday night, this thing I'm going to do on the whiteboard, but never mind. Hopefully we can learn from it again. So we're going to look at one aspect of our lives, probably all of us. If it's not an aspect of your life, I'm jealous. So we're going to look at stress, right? And what causes stress? So give me some ideas. What are the causes of stress in your life?
Finances.
Oh, let's use a green one.
No,
okay.
Red, black.
Finances. What else?
Relationships.
Relationships.
Too much work.
Too much work, absolutely.
Time management.
Time management. Health.
Aging.
Yes.
And media.
Media, yeah, it does, doesn't it? What else?
Traffic.
Oh. I feel like drawing a car, but I can't. I'll draw it. That's right. Yeah, traffic.
Environmental factors.
That includes all of that. Can you give me something a bit more
specific?
House maintenance. Yeah.
Not getting what I want.
Can I just call that dukkha?
Yeah.
So dukkha means unsatisfactoriness, which is basically every sort of not getting what one wants.
What about noise?
Noise, yes. Noise. I'm going to come back to noise. What about, for me, not enough sleep is a cause of stress? Yeah. Mm. What about caffeine? Does it cause stress?
Can do.
Maybe not then.
Not enough exercise.
Not enough exercise. Exercise.
Weight. Diet weight.
There we go. Diet weight.
Kids.
Yeah, kids. I put kids and cats.
Colleagues
can be.
Death.
All right. Pardon?
Death.
That's stressful.
To somebody it's stressful.
You mean bereavement?
Okay, I'll stop there, otherwise it's going to be too much for me to manage. Oh, now I've got to do this, right? So these are all impacting on stress in one way or another. Like that. They all affect, for some of us at different times, a little or a lot, our levels of stress. Exercise, yeah. Okay, so another way of looking at it, or another question really, is does stress affect these things?
Yeah.
Almost all of them. Oh, well, okay. Kids, cats and pets, does stress affect that? It does for me.
Yeah.
It affects my cat.
You can shout at the cat.
Actually, the cat doesn't like it. Does stress affect house maintenance?
Yeah.
Does it affect health? That's obvious. Does it affect death? Oh, yeah, true. It does.
It should, isn't it?
Relationships, yes. Media, maybe not. No. Aging, yes. Weight, yes. Finances?
Possibly.
Not getting what you want. How long does stress affect that? Yes. The specific exercise? Diet? Too much work. The stress effect? Not enough sleep? Oh, the stress effect? Traffic?
People.
Oh, yeah, true. And road rashes. The only one it doesn't affect is the media, but then maybe it does, actually. Think more broadly. About stress affects everybody else, so it affects everybody else, and then it affects the media. Right.
The media is mostly negative. I mean, I just think it's...
Yeah. Oh, parents. Stress affects parents. So, now we're getting on to the mutual causality bit. I mean, that's mutually causal, but we can go bigger than that and go, does exercise affect dukkha? Helen, the dukkha expert. Does dukkha affect exercise?
So dukkha affects exercise.
Does aging affect finances?
Yes.
Does weight affect aging and vice versa?
Yes.
Okay, what else? Oh, noise. Why did not have the noise? Does stress affect noise?
Yeah, we get noise.
Okay, does too much work affect noise?
Noise affects
too much work. Okay, can I join them all up?
Yeah,
I wasn't sure about that was going to work. Oh, too much work, yes, too much work affects traffic. Parents, do they affect traffic?
Can do. There's a lady on
It affects everything, doesn't it? Everything affects everything. Death affects health, yes. Okay, media probably affects everything too.
Yeah.
Anyway, you get the picture. I can't join it all up because it'll be even more of a mess. So maybe that's obvious. Let me read my little script. It might make it clearer. So.
Do you want to put the
thing back on? Yep. So. Even this one aspect of our experience, stress, one aspect. I mean, I know that's stretching it to call it one aspect, but anyway. Even this one aspect of our experience turns out to be part of a complex web of conditions, right? And none of these factors, you can't say that, or maybe you can, but I'll pose that it's not that one of these factors cause stress. All these factors interact or condition each other and stress arises. Yeah? So I want to make the distinction between cause. So by saying, I could say poor time management causes stress. That's the word cause. But actually, poor time management combined with too much traffic, too much work, annoying parents, a difficult cat, blah, 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 are all conditions that affect my stress levels, which is much more encompassing and actually much more accurate. So I want to make the distinction between cause and condition, because this talk is about conditionality, naturally. Okay? I've been a bit rebellious with this talk. I don't really feel like giving it, so now I'm just wanting to go and talk about something else. Briefly. So I work in a addictions rehabilitation centre. It's a residential facility where people come. They've got to be in a fairly difficult state to want to come and live at where I work for 18 weeks, but they do. And for many of them, and also I work a lot with their families and parents, the really important question is, what is the cause of my child's addiction, or what is the cause of my addiction? And I was thinking about that today, that it feels like cause is really important when you or someone you love has got a condition or a problem that is really, really painful. We want to know what's caused it. And my answer is always quite narrow still, but it's like, well, the research shows that it's probably a combination of genetics and a combination of early life experience, maybe also combined with adult experience, and that kind of encompasses quite a lot of conditions. But in a way, it's neither simple enough nor complex enough. It's not simple enough to satisfy the person as to why they're an addict or alcoholic. And it's not really complex enough to encompass this web of conditions that, you know, if I put addiction in the middle there, we'd have a similar web, maybe even more so. So I think I've been thinking, we want easy answers, don't we? If I'm stressed, I want to be able to exercise more and be less stressed, but it's probably not going to be like that. It might help, but there'll be a whole lot of other stuff coming in and also affecting my willingness or ability to exercise. So conditionality or Paticca Samuppada really encourages us to stretch out our ability to reflect on this web of conditions and notice our tendency to look for easy answers, easy cause and effect answers. One of the exciting things about this teaching is that conditionality works in, like, moving away from this. In fact, I'm going to move away from it so much I'm going to rub it off. Conditionality works in two different ways, and this is a teaching that the founder of our movement, Sangha Rakshita, has come up with, which is really helpful. So conditionality works in a reactive way, like this. Reactive, where I notice a piece of chocolate cake and I grab it. Yeah? It's kind of reactive. It's stimulus and response. Or in my case, the dog next door to my home barks and I feel annoyed. I've become quite conditioned to feel annoyed when that dog barks now. So that's the reactive way, and we all have that, you know, we roll out of the driveway in the morning, heading towards the motorway, and we notice there's this huge line of traffic, and we feel stressed. That's just a reactive response. There's no blame involved, it's just a reaction. But our teacher, Sangha Rakshita, said there's also another type of conditionality, which is creative. Do you see what I'm getting at with that little thing there? Yeah. So it's a creative response.
Which means we don't have to react.
Reactively. We can react creatively. Because there's two different types of conditionality. And this is not just what Sangharakshita taught. This is our teacher, our founder of our movement. This is what the Buddha taught. He taught about reactive conditionality, which is what's on the wheel, and creative conditionality, which is called the spiral path. And that's what Amaradipa will be talking about in 3 weeks' time. But my job tonight is to talk about the reactive type of conditionality. So, like I said, when we're in the reactive mode, we're a bit like a machine. We receive a stimulus and we respond. We feel bored. Before we even know we feel bored, we've reached for our phone. I've really noticed that for myself and other people. Before we even let the feeling of boredom arise, the phone is a convenient distraction. And there's many, many other distractions like that in modern life. Oh, we see an advertisement for the new iPhone 7. What happens? We want it. Just like that. It's a reaction, isn't it? Before we've even thought about it, do I want it? Do I need it? Have I got the money? It's like, I want that. And every time we do that, every time we react in those ways that have become habits, we strengthen those habits. That's just basic neuroscience. We strengthen the habits. So working with addictions, I talk about that a lot. If somebody who's in recovery has an urge to pick up a bottle of beer, say, and does so, they will just strengthen that habit to pick up a bottle of beer every time they feel bored or frustrated or stressed or whatever. If they resist that urge, then they start building new neural pathways that make it slightly easier to resist that urge the next time. So it's very a very optimistic teaching, actually. If we act in the same old way, we just do the same old thing and we get the same old results. And often those same old results are not exactly what we want, but we haven't got the spaciousness or the knowledge or the energy to think about doing anything different or to really ponder on that whole cycle of reactive behaviour. When we're in the creative mode, we do something a bit different. We think about it when we see an advertisement for the new iPhone 7. We go for a walk, say. Or when we feel bored, we meditate. Or when I see the piece of chocolate cake, what do I do? I grab an apple. When I hear the dog barking next door, instead of for the millionth time thinking about the letter I'm going to write to the council, I go and talk to the neighbour and offer to take the dog for a walk. You know, we do something more creative. And then new things start to happen. Maybe I become friends with the neighbours and I fall in love with the dog and, you know, whatever. New things happen. So now I'm going to talk about the Wheel of Life. And I want to hand out these because I know that's quite a long way away. So translate the image very briefly. It's a very dense symbol. So if it sounds a bit bland, it's because I'm doing it quite quickly. We could spend a whole weekend, a whole retreat on this. So, see the inner circle? You can see the pig, the rooster, and the snake. They are right at the hub of the Wheel of Life. They represent ignorance, greed, and aversion. And I just want to point out, we've got this pig, rooster, and snake up here. I really don't know where they came from, but they arrived one day to remind us that even in the Auckland Buddha Centre, we are subject to greed, hatred, and ignorance. And in the next circle, see there's a circle that's got darkness on the right-hand side and light on the left-hand side, just out from the pig. So the right-hand figures are falling down, looking really unhappy, and the left-hand figures are kind of walking up, perhaps looking a bit more happy. And one interpretation of that circle, at least, is that, well, in cyclic existence, in our lives, there's happiness and there's suffering, and that's the way it is, and it doesn't really make that much difference as long as we're stuck on the wheel of life. Do you see what I mean? They're still stuck on the wheel of life, whether they're happy or sad. The next circle, there's six, we call them six realms, six worlds, six ways of being, which Helen, I think, is going to talk about in a couple of weeks. Yep, so I won't go into that. And in the last circle, the rim of the wheel, there's 12 boxes, or 12, they're actually ovals, aren't they, with pictures in them. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time on them right now, because this is the, this when the, this is these six, these 12 boxes, or 12 nadanas as they're called, depict how Patichutsamapada works for every one of us, probably in every moment of the day. It's a minutely detailed depiction of the way we operate in the world. I'm actually freezing cold, so I'm going to go and put the heater on quiet. Okay, so we're on to the 12 links, or 12 nadanas. I'll try and stick with those two words. So they're called links or nadanas, and this outer circle is called the nadana chain. And it shows how we create ourselves and recreate ourselves all the time. Yeah, through what we do, what we think, what we say, and what we do. It's really a kind of a map of how we keep re-becoming our same old selves. Remember, this is the reactive path, not the creative path. So it's how we keep re-becoming our same old selves. In a way, I think it, you know, in the middle there's that inner circle of the pig, the rooster, and the snake, greed, hatred, and ignorance. I think this very outer circle unpacks that, really, unpacks and shows how it happens in action in our lives. So these, sometimes these 12 nadanas or 12 links are said to be seen to be taking place over three lifetimes. So the previous lifetime is what caused how we are in this lifetime, which then causes how we become in our next lifetime. But we can also see it as what happens just in this lifetime. So even if you don't believe in rebirth, or if you're not sure if you believe in rebirth, it's a really, helpful teaching, I suppose. So I'm not going to go around all of them. It would take quite a long time, which I don't have. I'm just going to explore a few of the kind of most crucial ones that lead to Amaradeepa's jumping off point when she talks about the spiral path in a few weeks. So the first link I want to talk about is the one right down towards the bottom of a woman and a man kissing. Can you see that? Yes? Yes, good. Okay, so that one is just called contact, right? That's straightforward contact. It's the contact between my eye and the ad for the new iPhone 7. The contact between my ears and the noise of the dog barking. The contact between my eye and the huge queue of traffic. Right? It's before anything else happens. That's contact. So I just want to really emphasize Buddhism is very good at breaking things down into tiny little steps like that. It's before I think, oh no, that damn dog. Before I even hardly even recognize it's the dog barking, it's that level of contact. It's happening all the time. I mean, there's millions of contacts in this, in that way, going on all the time just in this room. All the things we can look at, the things we're hearing, the thoughts we're having. Thoughts are also contacts. If I have a thought, that's a contact. So So we move around this Nidana chain clockwise, like most things. So you can see the next one is a man with an arrow in his eye, looking very pained. And that is feeling. I think he's looking very pained to emphasize that we can have very strong feelings, but actually it means feeling of whatever level of strength. And it's actually our initial bear response. It's without the stories that go with it. So it's like my dog barking example. It's dog barking and the initial negative response, or iPhone 7 ad, an initial positive response before I even move towards or move away. It's that level of feeling. And then conditioned by those feelings of pleasure, say for the iPhone ad or pain with the dog barking, we either grab at them or push them away. And that is illustrated by the woman offering, it's supposed to be a man, I think, something to drink. Yeah? And that's called craving. That's generally called craving, that Nidana. But that word craving is an umbrella term for craving and aversion. Do you see what I mean? It's the wanting and the not wanting. And conditioned by craving, we go on to the next one, which is this, the woman picking, I like to think it's an orange from a tree, which is called grasping or attachment. Yeah? So it's the moving towards or the moving away from. So I'll just go through it again. We have contact, feeling, craving, and now grasping. So we've broken down into what habitually often happens very, very quickly. We've broken that down into four steps already. So it's very minute, this 12 Nidana thing. It's a very microscopic look at how our minds work. And then conditioned by the grasping, we have becoming. And this is the pregnant woman. Yeah, that one is called becoming. So conditioned by my habitual act of grasping or aversion, moving away from, I become whoever I become. I become myself, actually. I become more and more of myself. I hear the dog barking. I feel annoyed. And I have a pattern of thinking how annoying that dog is. I can't live next door to noisy dogs. Maybe I start thinking that all dogs should be banned from the city. Every time I meet a dog, I think, oh no, barking dogs. You know, I become the person I become as a result of that. I mean, I don't actually, because I really love dogs, but I can feel it start to happen with my neighbour's dog, actually. I can see how it happens, right? Or maybe, you know, with the iPhone 7 or 6 or whatever it was. Is it 7? 6? 7. 7, yeah. You know, we habitually want, we become the sort of person that always wants the next gadget, the next best thing. And if we don't have it, we feel like we're somehow falling behind in some race that probably only exists in our own mind. So we become who we become. So that's what that little picture's showing. That's who we're becoming. So much of this happens automatically. We don't have any choice. What the point of this is, we don't have any choice with most of these links. They just happen. But actually, the creative bit that Amaradeepa is going to talk about in 3 weeks' time is where we do have a choice, and it's that gap between feeling and craving. Feeling being the man with his arrow in his eye, and craving being the woman with giving the man a drink. So there's a moment in there where we have a choice of how we respond. We can just keep on moving on to the new, to the re-becoming, or we can step onto the spiral path. But we have to be very self-aware to do that. We need to be able to really notice what's happening, and often we don't, and we just keep going around the wheel. And I'm not trying to be kind of really doom laden or negative. We do just keep on going around the wheel a lot of the time and keep re-becoming the person we keep re-becoming. But Buddhism points to this really lovely gap that with mindfulness, and this is why mindfulness is so important, we can widen that gap. So actually we can step into it and start creating ourselves as the sort of person we want to be, not the sort of person that gets annoyed every time a dog barks, or the sort of person who spends all their income on new gadgets, maybe, but you know, the sort of person we've actually decided we want to be. But yeah, you'll need to come along in 3 weeks' time to kind of find out more about that. So that gap, Sangharakshita, our teacher who talked about mind reactive and creative, he calls that the point of freedom. That is the point on this whole wheel of life where we have the freedom to choose who we are going to become in the future, where we can step off the wheel or stay on the wheel for, you know, more and more cycles. That's all I'm going to say. What I could do... No, I won't. I won't do any more. I'll just, if there's any questions, we can have a few questions now, or otherwise we'll just have a cup of tea.